702 and Cape Talk, the Literature Corner.
8 minutes before 11, in conversation with us now until noon, is the author of Firepool, Experiences in an Abnormal World, Hedley Twidell. Hedley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Eusebius. Hi.
Must be so nice, eh, to feel like many black South Africans when people are butchering your name.
Yeah, I'm used to it. You know, I should just change it to Twiddle, frankly.
Yeah, or just Sipo will do, dude. First and foremost, congratulations on this anthology. It's absolutely stunning for what opinion is worth.
Yeah, a lot. Thank you.
It is such an incredible range in terms of voice, almost quite literally so. Second person and then the third person. Thematically, it is also spanning everything from a really interesting meditation on the N2 highway all the way to nuclear and the politics around it. And acne, which was one of my favorite parts of this particular book. What was the genesis of this book? Was it the success of the essay on Coetzee that spurred you on to work on an entire anthology?
Yeah, it was quite interesting because, you know, I'm also, I work in a university, so I have to do other different kinds of writing as well, much slower, laborious kinds of writing. But I realized that the kind of essays that I was writing in my spare time were getting a much better reaction, and they seemed to be traveling a lot more than this stuff I was laboring over like a tortoise. So that was, you know, that was a great opportunity when that essay won an award. And I was kind of approached by a publisher. I wasn't convinced about that there was a book of essays, but what really fascinated me was drawing the different pieces together, some of which I've been worrying over and working over for, you know, the oldest one is about the hike with a terrible racist, and that's, you know, I started that about 15 years ago. So it was interesting drawing them together, and then when they were all together, seeing how there were some strange echoes and you know, they spoke to each other in strange ways. So it was strange moving from the short form into a sort of gallery or a larger array of pieces. Yeah,
but what I liked is that, I mean, obviously you were thinking very carefully about an array of pieces, as you put it, but in the academy, which for your sins you are located within, there's often an obsession with trying to be very hygienic with these genre distinctions. Mm, yeah. And actually what you've done nicely, which I enjoyed as a reader, is that you've allowed yourself incredible range instead of thinking, oh gosh, I don't want that person at an independent bookstore or at Exclusive Books being confused about where to put it in the bookstore. You simply got on with range.
Yeah. No, well, I'm glad you think that, because yeah, it was like each piece was in a slightly different gear, maybe a slightly different kind of genre. And yeah, I mean, I suppose it's interesting the difference between, you know, academic writing and this other kind of more ill-disciplined writing. And I think one of the differences is what gets me about, I don't want to caricature or, you know, demean academics and so on, but actually what does annoy me is that if you're writing in that more disciplined way, often people have to come across as very knowing, you know? Mm. So it's almost like you have to assume that, oh, and of course, as you know, they've said that, and as you know, and as you know, and actually maybe the person reading it doesn't know a damn thing about the subject. Mm. So, you know, what I like about this kind of writing and the writers I respond to is that they're people who actually start from nothing, from silence or from zero, and they don't assume a certain base of knowledge, and then they take you through a thought process. And you know, so there's this lovely line from Elizabeth Bishop where it's not a thought, but a mind thinking.
Absolutely. So, you know. Now listen, one of the best bits of advice I got for my first manuscript that has therefore never been published is that instead of describing too much, one needs to demonstrate certain things. So let's demonstrate what it is that Hedley has been writing. I put this on Facebook as well. I hope you don't mind. Hopefully it will get people to buy the book. And this is
I was touched that you took the trouble to type out so many paragraphs.
A cold country where the sun shines. I obviously, I love every single one of your essays. I am self-indulgently going to talk to you about two of them in particular and with our listeners to give them a taste of this anthology of yours, Hedley. But I just want to read from A Cold Country Where the Sun Shines. And this is what he says. Day three, you woke mid-morning to find everyone else had left much earlier. There was a note clipped to your hammock. Remember, river crossing by 2:30. Enjoy the walking, K&A. On a clipped-off contour, you replayed the previous evening's events. You had been thrown together for 5 days with a racist alcoholic. That much was clear. Or perhaps an alcoholic racist. Difficult to know where the emphasis should lie, since both these poisons were burning hot in Harry's throat. And as usual, you had reacted badly, in the sense of not reacting badly. Your default response in these situations is a kind of psychological cramp, a verbal windedness. Such comments, your cerebral cortex seems to decide, are simply inappropriate and best ignored, something too crass to even acknowledge hearing, especially amid the grand amphitheater of surf, cliff, and forest. Something that might just go away again if not indulged, just retract into its calcified and ugly shell. But Harry was playing a little game. The moment he clocked you for a university type, a liberal, then he knew he had some sport on the go and began fishing for a response. As you kept silent, he would up the ante. The black man comment was only the beginning, the overture to an evening in which all the familiar themes came out. You could hear them from the other fire, which you soon moved to, slowly crunching a vintook in your fist. The various genres of racism were duly demonstrated, floating across the campsite, the full gamut. Harry, the self-appointed anthropologist, and that is so typical of the black, the hard talk realists and scourge of political correctness. I call it as I see it. The historian of post-independence Africa, name one country they haven't stuffed up. The conspiracy theorist, it's a white genocide we're looking at with the farmers. The anxious homeowner, prices have halved since the suburbs have gone mixed. The out-and-out apartheid nostalgias. At least there was law and order back in the bad old days. You know what was amazing to me about reading that passage is that the aesthetic quality of it is absolutely amazing. Your control over language. Can you speak to me and to aspiring writers in particular, Hedley, about how you were able to sculpt such beautiful sentences when the fury of racism could have consumed you, and you may well, like many of us often do in our essays, have opted to prioritize argument over aesthetics?
Thanks, Eusebius. Thanks for reading that so beautifully as well. I'd say the first thing is time. I've been worrying about that experience and that my reactions for, as I said, about 15 years. You see, I just finished university abroad. I came home. I was full of the joys of spring. I was really in a spring tide of consciousness, doing this beautiful hike along the coast, so happy to be home. And I ran into this unreconstructed racist with a very silly name, which I won't give away. And, I've been turning it over ever since. And I remember at a seminar once, Njabulo Ndebele was talking about his kind of creative nonfiction. He talked about how one can tell if a writer's agonized, and he used the word agonized. So it's kind of a paradox that even, I'm really drawn to writers where the prose seems effortless. But to get that lightness and effortlessness, you've really got to work it. You've got to sculpt it. So, 90% of it is editing and removal. I mean, that's one of the amazing things.
Yes.
I think one learns is that creativity is maybe 90% subtraction, So you've got to leave the spaces for things to echo without getting in the way, maybe. Maybe that's one way of looking at it.
But we've had a real treat because this is the second day in a row now that we've had an essayist on. Yesterday we had Cesar Mpofu Walsh, and he was reflecting on the essay as a genre. And one of the things I appreciated that you write about in Fire Pool is along the way you make exactly the point that you have just started on, which is precisely that the essay is deceptive in its length. People think that less goes into it creatively and intellectually, but there's sometimes the danger of overwriting. There's also the pressure of economy of observation in terms of the language that you use. Talk to me about your thoughts on the essay, which I know you price as a genre, and I don't think enough people in this country do, including all sorts of award committees.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting word. It's, you know, my publishers didn't want to use it on the cover of the book, and I understood that because it partly has this kind of schoolmasterly quality to it, like write an essay, you know, composition. but I do love, there's also the etymology of it from French, which means, you know, to try, to essayer, to test something, to try something out, where you maybe not so much advancing a predetermined argument as trying something in prose. And of course that's an illusion because it's carefully worked out, but you give the illusion of testing and taking an idea for a walk. And I think what you said about, you know, the distillation and the subtraction or the shortness of it, the problem I have with a lot of writing online and in general is that it assumes quite an unintelligent reader. So it's always trying to fill in all the gaps, and it often becomes a rehearsal of what we know already. Or it's, you know, and also I find this in seminars. Often people, they seem to end where they should have begun, you know. So I think there's, if you remove all the redundant, the obvious, the what's already known, the things you're just putting there for to virtue signal, the things, yes, to, you know, or if you strip it all out, what have you actually got to work with?
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
But I think the other reason why it gets a bad rep is also because it is often confused with columns. There are many columnists that I love, but there's a difference between a column and an essay, isn't there?
Yes, there is. And I think it's about also the question of having an opinion, which of course, you know, there's very important genres of op-eds and columnists who play a hugely important role in the ecology of ideas and democracy. But there's also a moment when, which I find myself in quite often, where I don't know what my opinion is. and I struggle to understand how some people know what they think. So in a lot of these subjects, I've been trying to explore those psychological zones where you know, the wonderful thing about the essay is you can self-correct, you can self-revise. So often a writers that I love, they will sort of say something and then suddenly they will undercut everything that's just happened and you'll sort of bend into a different dimension. So that's opening up a different path for writing, you know, where you can show you can catch yourself out in your own self-delusions in a way.
Absolutely. 16 minutes before noon, we're talking to Hedley Twiddle about his book, Firepool, Experiences in an Abnormal World. You absolutely have got to buy this anthology. It is just one of the most beautiful books that I've read this year.
702 and Cape Talk, the Literature Corner.
Okay. You knew I was going to ask you about the very first essay in this anthology. I've been raving about it online.
Yeah, no,
A History of Adverse Reactions. It is just absolutely stunning. Because my first thought was, okay, clever UCT person is going to talk in some really deep way about the biology of race. But then you surprised me because it quite literally, besides being social comment about some of the schools we attended in the early post-apartheid experimentation of mixed race schooling and elite education, it also quite literally is about teenage acne. Tell the public what this one is about.
Yeah, well, A History of Adverse Reactions. I mean, you know, that's the little phrase you get on those terrible things with medication, where, you know, in the little liner notes, they tell you all the things that can go wrong with you. And I'm talking particularly about this miracle drug, Racketan, that arrived in the 90s.
And right up there with ecstasy and rage.
You know, it changed my life, all of them. So, I mean, the thing is, I was in the strange generation where I started school in a mining town, segregated school, and then it was the 90s. And my school was a conservative boarding school, so it didn't prioritize the history that was happening. But the way we did experience a transition was that suddenly South Africa was opening up to global currents and commodities and things. So suddenly there was real pornography there, you know, hustler, not just scope with stars on the nipples. There was ecstasy. There was rave culture arriving 10 years too late, but boy, we were happy to make up for lost time. And then there was this miracle drug, Racketan, which, you know, I think for those who could afford it, it marked a sort of historical rupture of, you know, because if you know, that really bad acne that people suffered from, it actually miraculously cured it. So I suppose I was exploring this strange, maybe miraculous transitions that weren't so miraculous.
But look, you go in deep, hey, Hedley,
yeah,
because you go into this in ways that I'd never thought before that is utterly hilarious. But also, as part of going back to Njabulo, you obviously take very seriously, without banalizing it, which is the other danger, the everyday experience and everyday life. When it comes to having zits, It's amazing how, as a teenager, like you say, it can be regarded as a moral failure. And yes, until this drug hit the market, you could have walked around at school as a moral outcast.
Yes, essentially. That's why people, when they, you know, you have a blemish on your face and people go, oh, no, it's just a bite. It's a spider bite, you know, as if like that, that's okay. You know, it's less of a moral failing than having some, you know, sebaceous, you know, outpouring in a pore. So you get into these very strange moralistic zones.
There's something else that happens in this essay, which I almost want to have you back on in another installment to only talk about the dictionary. The little footnotes were just delightful. And there's one word here I want to appropriate, but this, in this PC age, even as a gay man, I might be wrapped over the knuckles for this one. Let me read a little bit. So Hedley describes a trip back into Natal. And obviously boys are boys and bullying happens and all sorts of things. And then you watch all sorts of movies as well. And he writes the following. I'm sort of taking it out of context because I want to get to a particular point here. Sharon Stone and one of the Baldwins were cavorting in an eerie apartment block watched on CCTV by some sinister voyeur. Video footage of humans having sex, which these porn barons with access to X-rated VHS tapes covertly termed wildlife, was vanishingly rare. I didn't really want to see this, but not, you know, here with Brando's face pressed up against mine, making sure my eyes stayed locked on the screen. Again, there was no way to do the right thing in these situations. What? This isn't turning you on. Are you gay? Are you a Stubbs? And then there's a little footnote here. Stubbs, none. A homosexual. Derogatory. E.g., that new matric is a Stubbs. Origin from Zulu, Isitabane, which is a homosexual. I was rolling on the floor when I read that. Tell us a little bit about this dictionary.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think often the
I've never heard of Stubbs, by the way. I think
it was big back in those days. I don't know if it's gone out of fashion. No, I mean, just moments of humiliation, you know, and one of them for me is this little dictionary I produced at school of our strange lingo that we had, because, you know, this is part of the paradox that even as you know, it was so vicious and sadistic, there was such verbal creativity, because we know that swearing and abuse, it's such a site of human ingenuity, nicknames, you know.
Yeah.
And so I made this dictionary and I sold it for a huge profit. It was my one great moment of entrepreneurship. And it was the one thing I was remembered for from the school, you know, not the fact that I'd written a very important organ fugue or something. It was like, oh, you wrote the dictionary. And people would be like, oh, it's great. And I mean, I'd never look at it because it gets much worse than what you've just read. So I was using it as a way to go back there and again to, you know, to sort of explore the viciousness and the, you know, overheated male atmosphere, but also to recognize that there were intimacies and affections and almost a sort of weird nostalgia for a place and a time which certainly produced narrative. You know, for years afterwards, I went to the UK, I was there, and I just used to dine out on all these things that had happened to us in these institutions. So it's a sort of strange reaction that one has looking back. And, you know, George Orwell's piece about his school days, which has got this wonderful sarcastic title, Such Were the Joys. This was a big influence for me because he was working on that essay on his deathbed, you know, as he was dying on a small island off Scotland, and he'd seen fascism, he'd seen Spanish Civil War, and he went back to his school days to think about power and humiliation and solidarity. And so, you know, it's like a petri dish in which you can see these cultures being you know, spreading and interacting. And the dictionary was a way, a sort of very embarrassing way, but a way back to those days.
I want to see the full dictionary because I...
I would never. No, I've burnt all cup. No, you can't.
we all have a pass. 10 minutes before noon.
702 and Cape Talk, the Literature Corner.
Okay, Hedley, now that we are officially friends, we'll have to have you back because there's so much more we're going to have to talk about. Let's just see whether we can entice even more people to read the book. So we're going to be fairly random in selecting some of the essays, just to give a description of what they're about. I am absolutely obsessed, as my listeners know, with Selo Dekker. And unsurprisingly, 27 years was one of my favorites. I'm not as good at appreciating jazz as you are. But tell us about how wonderfully you connected the lives of a bunch of South Africans who were so incredibly talented. I think the only thing we can debate in a different forum is whether untimely is a word that we should use as often as we do, because I think in Sello's case, certainly, the life he lived that produced his brilliance could not have produced the same brilliance if he lived a careful life.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, this it began with listening to the music of Moses Taiwo Molelekwa when I was younger, and I was just so astonished by his work, particularly when he was just a solo artist. And he seemed to have digested, in such a deep way, such a huge range of Southern African musical idioms, you know, whether it was Cape jazz, Sepedi music, you know, jazz from Joburg, Mbira, and he could move between them so fluently. And I guess in the piece, I contrast his work with Sello Dekker's, where, you know, Sello Dekker's work is, it's difficult. Its tonality is quite minor. It's concerned with trauma and pain. And at the same time, this artist, Molelekwa, his music seemed to encode, it was often working from the major tonalities, which are, you know, an important part of the South African sound. Mm. But then, you know, when I was young, my piano teacher told me, you know, there's minor, which is sad, and major, which is happy. But then I got interested, you know, what does it mean to express pain and broken history, which, you know, through supposedly major tonalities, you know, yeah. how do those sound through in the music? And so I use that as a kind of counterpoint between the two artists as I put together this piece. And it's in 27 sections. Taiwo was 27 when he died.
Yeah.
And for each section, I found it a very difficult piece to write. It's very difficult to write about music, obviously. And so every time I thought I'd made an error or I'd hit a wrong note, I would stop, and then I would restart the piece. So it's essentially 27 opening paragraphs. Mm. And that was a very interesting thing for me to try, because, you know, when you start a piece of writing, you have to give a certain amount of basic info, right? So you have to say,
yes,
the pianist and composer Moses Taiwo Molelekwa. So when you continually restarting, you have to keep on making these repetitions. So they became almost like incantations or riffs. Mm. So it took on this strange musicality in its form. So I was playing with all these metaphors. Also, as you say, of being in time. What does it mean to be in time? What does it mean to be late? What does it mean to be, you know, out of time? What's the time signature of the 90s? What does it mean to listen to that period?
Absolutely.
What does it mean to listen to Sello Dekker's prose? You know, what can we hear in it?
I think you do it beautifully, particularly also skewering, notwithstanding the thousands of brilliant music teachers that we have in this country, that false dichotomy between the minor and the major. It never even occurred to me, for example, as you point out, even in pop music, if you think of a track like Killing Me Softly by Roberta Flack, that there you have a fantastic example of a song that is written in the minor mode, but which actually ends on a major chord. And I thought, I'd never actually realized that, but you're absolutely spot on. Listen, we've got 1 minute left. The other great achievement in this anthology is that you are, in a good way, curious about characters that have almost been on the margins of history for whatever reason, and you lift them back to the surface. The subtitle is Experiences in an Abnormal World. Just describe to our listeners where that subtitle comes from, and in 30 seconds, why you had a curiosity about the person who wrote it.
It comes from a letter written by Dimitrios Tsafendas, the forgotten assassin of Hendrik Verwoerd, the man who committed the most spectacular unparliamentary behavior in our history, but who most people don't seem to remember. They remember something vague about him having a tapeworm, but he had the most extraordinary wandering life of racial humiliation, racial ambiguity, and he somehow took down the father of apartheid, the man of granite, because of Verwoerd's own policies of job reservation in the middle of parliament. And so I tried to explore this history of a man who was deemed mad, but who actually gave at some points very very lucid reasons for his act, and at some point was clearly delusional. So, you know, how do we deal with someone who can't easily be made into a historical meaning or a historical figure?
Yeah. Mm. Hedley, congratulations. I wish you many, many, many happy sales with this anthology and further writing to come from you. And we'll look forward to again hosting you in the program. Thanks so much for coming on today.
Thanks so much for having me, Eusebius. Thank you.